Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 417th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And with us today, James, we have Dr. Tina Koronek, who has usurped control of the peer group and ran me out of town.
As she should have.
Years ago.
Years ago, because of all the legal issues.
And the intervention.
So that aside, we're going to talk about exactly what today, Mike?
Well, Tina's going to lead us through the new Managing Opioid Use Disorder in Primary Care guideline that just came out in Canadian Family Physician and has made quite a splash. splash, James.
And it's definitely a splash because there are a lot of issues around the evidence and the peer group, and we'll talk about the process. They do a very thorough job of looking at the evidence and trying to come up with the guidelines that are relevant to primary care, and they deal with all the salient points, if you will, of the specific issue. And Tina's going to work us through all of them.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Tina, well, you're a family doctor, aren't you? I don't. Maybe the audience hasn't heard of you before.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, so I am a family physician. I work here in Edmonton, and I am an associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine at the university. And as Mike alluded to, now I am the director of peer, which doesn't mean much, I'm afraid. But there you go.
What about all the extra money that you get from being director of peer? But it did mean that you end up being in charge of a large grant of from our provincial government in order to address, from a primary care perspective, opioid use disorder.
Yeah. This is a really interesting topic because one of the things we pride ourselves in peer is to sort of pick topics that we think are common and we see a lot in primary care. And honestly, this might not have been at the top of our agenda, but there continues to be a big problem with regards to opioid use disorder and opioid deaths. And if you look at the stats, it's actually pretty impressive. Unfortunately, how many people are passing away from this as compared to other things that we talk about all the time? So we were asked to participate in the development of a guideline around this topic. And I have to say it's been a huge learning experience and something I'm really glad that we did and really proud of in the end.
Yeah, for sure. Because we went from a place. One of the things about what we do at peer when we do guidelines is we try and come at it from a perspective of we're not the specialist in the area. And so we're going to look at things hopefully a little bit more objectively and that kind of thing. But in this case, we manage lipids. We see patients asking for cannabinoids. And certainly the pain issue around that is much more bread and butter to what we do. But this was a bit different for us. There are lots of family doctors who make the management of substance use a big part of their practice or their entire practice. But for us, it's a bit of a bit foreign to us. We deal with patients with it, but we weren't as comfortable in this area. So thank goodness we had a committee to help us and all of that. But Tina, you want to take us through first just how many, like, because you alluded to the fact that this is a huge problem, and I think you have some stats just for Alberta alone.
Yeah, so in Alberta, if you look at the stats that they put out, about 700 people die a year, which is about 2 per day. And trying to put that into context, I think it's sort of interesting to look at if you look at, say, influenza, which is something we hear about all the time that scares a lot of people in Alberta over the same period, about 90 died from influenza compared to 700 from opioid use overdoses. And a lot of those are in younger people, right, which is somewhat alarming. And so what else kills younger people? Well, things like motor vehicle collisions. And in Alberta, there was about 300, so less than half that number of people dying from overdoses. So it's a huge, quite sobering when you look at numbers. And then when we presented this, actually, when we were in at the rural conference, someone piped up and said, you know, in BC, that's even worse. And it is. It's true. BC is about double that. There's about almost 1,500 deaths over the course of last year, which is about four people a day. So the numbers are huge across the country. And it's something that we don't talk a lot about. And maybe I think part of it, what I've come to understand in primary care, because we didn't know what to do, and we didn't think there was anything we could do. So we sort of tend not to address those topics.
Yeah. And also we don't, if you're a family doc, who's not, who's got a practice in, let's say, Alberta, and you're in kind of working in the suburbs, you can go many, many years without seeing anyone with a bad opioid. They can certainly have substance use disorder, but without a bad outcome. Mm-hmm. And so it's easier for us to not kind of think about it or be prevalent in our mind compared to flu, which we're inundated with information. There's a flu campaign every year, et cetera. And so it's not a surprise that this isn't our comfort zone as much, but it should be. And I think that's what you addressed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a stigma associated with it, you know, in contrast to things like the flu and cardiovascular disease and so on.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's part of it. That's something I think our whole team has gone through a transition over this past year. That idea of, what if you looked at opioid use disorder more as a chronic disease, as opposed to this sort of condition that's associated with a lot of stigma and people making bad choices and what have you. And if you reframe it as a chronic disease that we have tools to manage and we can help, it really kind of sets it into a different perspective. And again, maybe I hope what this guideline will do is normalize the treatment in primary care. Because historically we had treatments like methadone, but methadone was scary for a lot of us, myself included, because you needed special training. There's a lot of things that went into that. You sort of heard of the potential dangers of it. And now we have other medications that maybe aren't as scary, and some of those restrictions are being removed. And maybe we can sort of normalize it within primary care and say, this is just one other treatment we have for many of the chronic diseases that we see.
And one of the things that people will wonder about, Tina, is why did we do an opioid use disorder guideline when there's already one that came out in the CMHA in 2018? And I think one of the reasons is, and this happened even before, Tina, I can't remember why you were away at this one point. I think it was summer vacation, but that's when we ramped up our application for this. And I was going to, you had gone to the first meetings, and then I went to the next set of meetings. But there was, at that point, there was no guideline. This goes all the way back to 2017. Mm-hmm. And we were being asked, you know, there was an enthusiasm to get primary care involved, and in Alberta and sometimes around the country that ends up getting the peer group involved. And so we were at meetings and talking about this, but there was really no guidance document at the time. And as ours always are, ours was an intention to focus directly on primary care. And so even though another guideline came out in 2018, in the CMAJ, ours still has a focus on primary care and has a slightly different approach, being that it's mostly from primary care doctors and it's targeted directly to primary care.
Yeah, exactly. Like you mentioned, so that guideline wasn't out when we started. It came out during the process. And when we present, we always say that that's a great guideline, and we're sort of just standing on the shoulders of that guideline, because there's additional questions that could still be answered. And even when that guideline was out, when our committee came together and said, what are the questions we have about opioid use disorder management? We just had pages and pages of questions. So there's still so many things that could be addressed in a primary care setting that it made sense to build on that and to sort of expand that a little bit further, for sure.
And you guys have reported this and talked about it, is that, you know, many of the guidelines don't necessarily include primary care, and for that reason, they don't answer the questions that you guys have, which I know you guys have found frustrating in the past. But it's and that's one of the approaches that is taken by peer to identify what should be in the guideline, and that's exactly what you guys did with the committees and everything that you put together.
Yeah, exactly. And Otina, you want to go ahead and talk a little bit about how we make a guideline committee and that kind of thing?
Well, I was just going to make one more quick comment about this guideline, because the previous guidelines were excellent, and they told you there's evidence of benefit for these treatments. But I really feel that there's a lot of primary care docs who are still quite skeptical about this whole area. And so one of the things we tried to do with the guideline we came up with was provide them with actual numbers. Here's the outcomes that we found. Here's the actual numbers. Give them the actual evidence to help them sort of make those informed decisions. So that's another step we tried to take with these guidelines, just to sort of empower primary care to go ahead and potentially treat their patients.
And also, Tina, just what you were indicating, we try and provide as much transparency as possible. So when you see the recommendation, it's not because this reduces outcomes of importance, which what are those outcomes? How much does it reduce them? All of those kind of things. We actually provide what are the outcomes we're reducing? What is the actual numbers for benefit? How good are those studies? We provide a lot more details in our guidelines than I think a lot of people do, as James has written articles on before, that allow you to do shared decision making.
Yeah, exactly.
So one of the things I want to bring up, because I think our guideline process is interesting, I think, for some people, is we as a team, as the peer team, sit down and try and devise a guideline committee. And what we do when we look at our guideline committee is we create a, for lack of a better term, a skills matrix, where we look across what kind of practice do people do? Where are they practicing? What part of the country? Is it rural? Is it urban? Is it et cetera? And we make kind of a grid, and we collect some names if we think people who might be good in this area or good for this guideline. And we always pick a lot of generalists. And when we pick, even within the specialties, we pick family doctors who are subspecializing in this area or have a focus practice. And it's not that we exclude specialists, but we make sure that we have an adequate representation of family docs. And that is approaching kind of 50%. Then we add nurses, nurse practitioners, social workers, that kind of thing. Tina, do you want to make any other comments about that?
No, I would just comment that we do really highly value the input of our specialist colleagues. Get a psychiatrist on our committee who we thought was, provide some valuable insight as well. But I do agree the goal is to have a fair representation of primary care, which is sort of the inverse of what we've seen traditionally with guidelines. In this one as well, we're also looking at getting patients involved. So people with lived experience, which is something we did on this guideline just to help inform us with regards to recommendations.
Yeah, that's good. Because we started that process in the cannabinoid guideline. For the lipid one, we just had people, we had peer reviewers who were patients, and then cannabinoids, we added one, this one, we added one. And I think that's the future of our guidelines. And then Tina, do you want to talk about how the actual process, the kind of iterative process which they select questions?
Yeah, for sure. So first we ask everyone to just submit a list of questions that come up around this topic. And like I said, we did literally have pages of questions, which I thought was worthy of a publication in and of itself, sort of this, all the questions that arise around the management of this. And then as a committee, we tried to come up with sort of our top 10 questions, and we ended up with a few more than that, but that was our goal. And then those questions are questions that we submitted to the evidence review committee. So our committee of sort of evidence experts who would complete the evidence review on those topics. So we did each question, we did a systematic review for. So in the end, we actually did 17 systematic reviews, which is insane, especially given the timelines. This particular project was under very tight timelines, given the push, particularly from the government, to get some information out to primary care practitioners. So we did 17 systematic reviews and provided that evidence back to the committee, and which allowed them to review what is the best evidence on this and combine that with their, collective experience to come up with some recommendations around the management of opioid use disorder.
Perfect. Yeah. And the iterative process, when the committee comes up with the list of questions, we as the peer group take those questions. We see if any of them overlap, and if they do, we condense them into one. We create a big list, we give it back to the committee and say, now try and rank your top 10, and then we score those rankings so that best of our ability, we come up with the kind of top 10, and as Tina said, in this case, a little more questions from the committee. So it's not really the peer group who's coming up with the questions. It's the committee that's coming up with the questions, and the peer group is the poor bums who have to do all of the looking through the papers and that kind of thing.
But I think it's very important, and it's one of the reasons why we're spending a little bit of time going over the nuance of this, about why the guidelines that we, the peer group, are putting together are different. You know, when you look at other guidelines, as we, Mike and you, and we've talked about this before, they don't often provide, they just talk about what evidence they found. They don't give the nuances or the numbers. They don't necessarily have the direct questions that are very important to help you make decisions. And that's the I think the clever part, or why I think these are so valuable, and why we're going over in detail the approach, because it is almost fundamentally different, I think. I know it does provide more useful information to the vast majority of primary care providers who see these patients, not just opioid use disorder patients, but everything.
Yeah, and I think that idea of the questions don't even come from peer. They come, we build a committee from across Canada and different regions and all of that stuff, and it's rich in primary care, not just family doctors, but all primary care providers. And then they, in their review, are the ones that select the questions. So it's a much different process than what you would see with standard guidelines, where it's the questions are chosen by the panel of experts who write the guideline. This is chosen by frontline clinicians who are primary care focused, and they're choosing the questions that are relevant to them. And I think that the very foundation of the process is quite different.
So Tina, why don't you go over the top questions, and then that will give a sort of a outline for what we're going to talk about over the next few podcasts.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the first questions that I loved that our committee came up with is, where should opioid use disorder be managed? That idea, should it be managed in primary care, or are we not well equipped and maybe our specialist colleagues who have additional training should manage it? And I thought that was just a real fundamental question, because that kind of provides us with a path of where to go from there. And then the next question, which we hear all the time, is how do we diagnose this, particularly in chronic pain patients? How do we do that? And then questions around efficacy and safety of different pharmacotherapy options. So buprenorphine, naloxone, methadone, naltrexone, and cannabinoids, because we hear that coming up a lot lately, particularly with the legalization of marijuana. Other questions that came up was the evidence for prescribing practices. So in primary care, of course, it's not just prescribing, say, an opioid agonist therapy, but what do we do about contracts? What do we do about urine drug screens? What about witnessed ingestion versus giving patients medications to take home? All those questions came up. And then what about tapering opioids? So in other conditions like alcohol use disorder, we would just stop the alcohol. But, you know, what's the evidence for doing that in an opioid use disorder setting? Questions around psychosocial interventions came up. Are those beneficial? Question around residential treatment. Is that a good intervention? And then finally, one of my personal favorites from a primary care point of view is, how do we manage comorbidities in patients who are on pharmacotherapy for opioid use disorder? So if they're being treated with an opioid agonist therapy, you know, what's the best evidence for how I manage their ADHD or their anxiety or their insomnia? Is there any evidence on those? Those were, I thought, really great questions.
And I think, and to answer all those questions, the approach that is taken is, you got to, what are the true outcomes that are really important to answer those? And that's, again, another process that peer goes through.
Yeah. So this is a great exercise. When we, as Mike alluded to, when we started this, we weren't particularly familiar with this literature. We weren't particularly familiar with the research around it. And so we sat down as a committee, and this again was our committee, and said, what are the things we think are important outcomes when it comes to looking at opioid use disorder? And so commonsensically, they sort of said, well, we think if we can improve mortality or morbidity, if we can improve societal outcomes like reduce crime or improve employment or those sorts of things. And then quality of life would be one. And we sort of kept moving down the ladder, and sort of at the bottom would be the surrogate outcomes, like things like treatment retention. You know, can we keep people in treatment, or opioid use? Those would be the surrogate outcomes that we thought. So our goal was really to find outcomes on morbidity, mortality, those sorts of things. But unfortunately, when we started looking at the evidence around this, we found that most trials don't report on those outcomes. Actually, that's very rare. By far, the most commonly reported outcomes are treatment retention. So can we keep patients in treatment, and opioid use outcomes?
And there were lots of limitations to the work, right? Like there's a ton of limitations in, but besides the level of outcomes that we're looking at, the hierarchy of outcomes, we had to stick to the lowest, but we had to rely on the lowest outcomes. But there were lots of other issues as well, yeah. Tina.
Yeah, this is in a way, it's somewhat disappointing that we have this huge problem. We've been prescribing opioids for, you know, decades. And the literature based around this is actually very poor, I would say. Even the terminology, there's no consistent terminology. And anyone who's sort of listened half-heartedly to the news will hear that, you know, over the decades, we've changed how we even talk about this. Is it heroin abusers or opioid users or people with addiction or people who use opioids? And then all the different lingo for how you treat it. Is this opioid replacement therapy? Well, some people will say, no, we're not replacing or substituting it. It's an opioid agonist therapy. And so the terminology keeps changing. And so for the poor peer suckers, me included, trying to search the literature and find all the relevant articles was a bit tricky. And even when we did find studies, they're generally very small, very high dropout rates. And they're not the level of quality we would see in many other areas. And say, compared to cardiovascular trials, it's not even a comparison. I mean, a lot of these trials had multiple outcomes. They didn't indicate even what their primary outcome was. They just measured everything and reported what was significant. So really somewhat disappointing. We'd love to see better research in this area, but we had to take what we could find. Which is often not very much, I'm afraid.
But it's really, you know, important to know the limitations of the best available evidence. And when you know that, it's actually really quite empowering, because it helps, you know, work your way through how to deal with many of these issues.
Yeah, it's you're right, James. And from having participated in the systematic review, though, it was the reason I'm slowly going bald is because of these kind of projects. It's trying to, you go in and you're like, well, you know, this is called substance use disorder. No, it's not. It's defined as the DSM. No, it's not. Like, and there's so many different nuances to the phrasing. And if you search under opioid use disorder, you're going to miss the articles that just listed their article under heroin abuse, yeah, or heroin misuse, or what have you. And as a result, we had to keep going back and saying, okay, where could these secret articles be? So it was, and it's not just us. It's interesting. Once you start reading the literature more and more, you hear that this is a constant frustration. Right now we're working on a tools for practice that shows that this problem is recurrent in whatever area of substance use disorder you're looking at. There's very inconsistent use of a diagnostic standard. There's inconsistent use of language. And they all of the reviewers who look at this kind of content are frustrated by that.
Yeah, it's so true. It's like medicine's poor cousin or something. Like, what? It really is a different world, which is unfortunate. But I do agree with you, James, that it is absolutely empowering as a primary care clinician to realize this is the best evidence. So, yeah, when you're struggling and not sure, or you're getting different people telling you different stories, it's based on this. Yeah.
And it's why we spent almost an entire podcast talking about how these guidelines are put together, the process behind them, and that it is important, because I know the CMAJ guideline that you were talking about, as you go through it, you cannot, one, these questions, not all these questions by any stretch, are answered, and they very rarely use any numbers or magnitude, and it's it's just not done. And that's why I think, and I hope that what we provide on this podcast is that additional piece of information. So rather than just telling you what to do, you at least have an appreciation for the limitations. And if there is an effect, how big of an effect and what to expect and all that, because as we've all come to appreciate, that is an empowering process. It is also exceedingly frustrating, but I think it's a great, it just makes life far more difficult, but far more easy.
The process of doing the evidence review is much more difficult, but the process of applying the evidence becomes much easier once it's summarized. Yeah,
exactly.
So, Tina, why don't we just, to finish off this podcast, why don't you just tell us about the real mystery that we started with? Because this is the linchpin, is where is OUD best managed? Where is opioid use disorder best managed? Because that's, if the answer to that is best managed in specialty clinics, I think the people can miss the next two podcasts.
Exactly. Yeah, I was really surprised. I didn't think there would be anything in the literature about this, but we kind of said, well, again, this was brought up by our committee. We said, well, let's look and see. And it turns out there are a number of RCTs looking at the management of opioid use disorder in primary care compared to a specialized opioid treatment center. So we were able to meta-analyze three randomized controlled trials that compared those two, and they looked at the traditional outcomes I just talked about. So retention and treatment, which is what you see most commonly. So retention and treatment is significantly better in a primary care setting as compared to specialty care. So 86% compared to 67, which is a number needed to treat of about 6. And similarly, street opioid abstinence is better when these patients are managed in a primary care setting compared to specialty care, with a number needed to treat of 6 again. So 53% compared to 35. And one small RCT looked at patient satisfaction and just asked, you know, how satisfied are you? And patients were very satisfied more often in primary care with a number needed to treat of about 3. So it was 77% versus 38%. So this was really actually enlightening for some of us. Like, oh, wow. And I think James has said this before, not that it's a competition at all. It's more of a, can we do this in primary care? Again, empowering primary care, is this something that we are okay in managing?
I think it's important to show that, you know, at least in the worst case scenario, it's at least no difference. Now, it's not a competition, but, you know, for some people, it'll be more valuable in primary care. Maybe for some patients, it'll be more useful in a specialist care. And I mean, the bottom line is that this can be done in a variety of settings.
Yeah, exactly. The one caveat to these trials that I just spoke of is that they all included some element of additional training or support. So they had consultants available. They all received a bit of additional training sort of in that team environment. So when we were looking at a recommendation around this topic, there was a significant debate amongst our committee. You know, is this something should we say you can do this in primary care, or do we need to add that caveat if you have appropriate supports, you can do this? And some members of our committee pushed back and said, you know, I really think primary care can do this and you don't need a huge team. And what sort of pushed us in that direction is, and this wasn't even a question that originally came up, but we found it when we were reviewing the literature, is these trials looking at the initiation of opioid agonist therapy compared to just leaving a patient on a wait list. So some trials out of the United States where patients had to be on a wait list for up to 3 months to get into methadone treatment. So they were just initiated on the medication. So no additional supports, nothing besides just given a medication. And it turns out in those patients who were just given the medication, there was a significant benefit with retention and treatment with the number needed to treat of 3. And so that sort of pushed us over the edge with our recommendation to say, you know what, the evidence suggests that just initiating opioid agonist therapy without any other supports, that still significantly improves those outcomes of retention and treatment and opioid use, and pushed us to make that recommendation that, yeah, this can be done in primary care and you can do it even if you don't have additional supports.
Awesome. That's great. And as James says, even if this, even if these numbers are exaggerated, it's highly improbable that it will reverse entirely with future research, unless that some of the old research that showed certain clinics were better than primary care generally had a lot more resources. And so if you invest in those extra resources, often you can show that something else is better. But in this case, I think it's pretty reliable at this stage that opioid use disorder can be managed in primary care quite well. And James, anything else to add?
I was going to say, and because of that, now we need to go over all of the best available evidence about the questions that we talked about at the beginning. How do you diagnose it? You know, what treatments are effective? You know, the whole concept of screening and blah, blah, blah. And so that's what we're going to do over the next probably two podcasts, is to take what was found in the systematic review, give you guys the evidence, the numbers, and then and sort of weave through that sort of the approach that the peer group came up with from the guidelines. So no, great job. I mean, it's you know, this takes, I think it took a weekend to do this guideline, Tina.
Oh, I don't think the whole weekend, James.
Yeah. Oh no, it wasn't even a long weekend. So so you can hopefully people can appreciate and why we went through this process of what goes into it, because there is an awful lot of work, but I think it you get a lot of additional value on top of what you see with basic normal guidelines. And one of the reasons we do this is because we bitched and complained about guidelines for so long. That, you know, a bunch of people saying, well, okay, you do it. And
that's mostly you, James. That's mostly you. I've been always very positive and cheery. At least that's how I remember it.
Yeah, that's that's a very interesting observation from someone who has virtually no insight. So as people who know, who have listened to the podcast before, they know by the time we get to this stage, there's nothing more useful. But Mike, is there anything that you want to sell or let people know about what your group is doing?
So the peer group, we're working on preparing the PIPE conference, but that's a long way out yet. Once it gets a little bit closer, we are going to have a PIPE conference this year that is completely free of industry involvement. So not only no industry sponsorship, which we've never had, but we're also, none of the speakers will have industry relationships this year. So we're taking that next big step, James. And as far as the National College goes, we're still continuing to put out our webinars and keep an eye on that. And in the and we've also introduced an antenatal course, which is completely free and heavy in structural design course. So it's going to have a lot of kind of interactive components, online learning, up to 7 credits. So you can check that out at the National College website.
Awesome. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.